Hello and welcome to this Footprint Packaging podcast in association with Nestlé Professional. My name's Nick Hughes, Associate Editor at Footprint, and I'm delighted to be joined by an expert group of guests to discuss the subject of packaging materials and substitution within the food service sector. Plastic reduction remains a key priority for businesses as they seek to achieve their environmental goals. This in turn has created interest in alternative packaging materials like paper, as well as novel materials like seaweed. But are businesses making the right choices when switching out of plastic? Over the course of the next 40 minutes, we'll explore this and other key questions in company with our guests. So let's meet them. James, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, yes. Thanks, everyone. My name is James Marsh. I'm a senior packaging specialist working for Nestlé in the UK and I market.
Thank you. And Martin?
Yeah, I'm Martin Kirsch, Executive Director of the Food Service Packaging Association. Our members make, distribute, and generally very much get involved with all the packaging which is used for the UK's food service and hospitality sectors.
Great. And Justin?
Yes, hello, everyone. I'm Justin Turkey. I'm the Director of Sustainability at Bunzl Catering and Hospitality Division. So we procure and distribute food catering supplies to a very broad range of customers throughout the UK and beyond that globally as well.
And David?
Hi, my name's David Burrows and I'm Associate Editor at Food Service Footprint.
Well, welcome to you all. James, perhaps I can start with you. How would you summarise Nestlé's strategic priorities where packaging sustainability is concerned?
We know there's a problem with packaging waste in the UK and globally, and with Nestlé's size comes a huge responsibility. And we really are working very hard towards a future where none of our packaging, including plastics, will end up in landfill or litter. And some people might think that's almost an impossibility. And we know it's going to take a lot of time to achieve this. But we're trying to tackle this with a wide range of actions. And we've organised our actions around five pillars and three big themes. And if I can just quickly run through those, if you don't mind, I think that will give listeners an understanding of what we're trying to achieve at Nestlé. So we have three major themes, which is less packaging, better packaging, and better systems. So under less packaging, what are we trying to do? We are trying to reduce the amount of packaging that we put on the market, the amount of plastic packaging material in general, and virgin plastics in particular. So we want to eliminate any unnecessary, any problematic packaging as defined by the UK Plastic Pact. We've reduced the size of our sharing bags, for example. We're reducing our use of virgin plastic. Buxton Water is now in 100% rPET. And we've committed to reduce our use of virgin plastic against our 2018 volumes by one third by 2025. Better packaging. We're looking at redesigning our packaging, pioneering alternative packaging materials to facilitate recycling. We set up the Nestlé Packaging Institute in 2019, and we have packaging testing centres all around Europe looking at packaging in terms of how we can improve it and ensure that it's designed for recyclability. And then better systems, we're looking at recyclability and recycling and rethinking our behaviours. With recycling, we support infrastructure that helps to shape a waste-free future. We've invested in innovative recycling facilities in the UK. And we want to rethink all of our behaviours because Nestlé and other FMCGs can design packaging to be recycled and can design reuse and refill systems. But if we don't put it in the right bin, if we don't reuse it, if we don't recycle it, if we don't refill it, it's just going to be reusable or refillable packaging that's going to end up in landfill. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, the Nestlé packaging strategy going forward.
And Martin, would you say that the priorities James has outlined there, essentially less and better packaging and better systems, is representative of the priorities of the wider sector?
Well, less and better packaging, I mean, I think it has to be said, it's something that, you know, the packaging industry has always been trying to achieve. Packaging that is used tends to be the packaging which is right for the job and does the job to its best ability. I mean, a worry that we would have, and others I know share, is that we could end up compromising the effectiveness of packaging. And that, of course, is going to have unintended consequences for food waste and, ironically, for increasing carbon as well. I think the exercise here should be about resource efficiency. and using the materials that we have as efficiently as possible. Some of that must come from improved productivity. And, you know, lots and lots of articles about the UK and how poor it is on its productivity, and money doesn't, or insufficient funds get put into new machinery investment. And I think there will be environmental improvements as machinery improves. But to do that, of course, money has to be spent rather than businesses sitting on, you know, sitting on cash mountains. But also the better use of materials. And it's not just the materials, it's also energy and water. This is all part and parcel of it. And then finally, it's investment in more efficient recycling and the systems used to collect the packaging. That, of course, should have come from the what was then the government's consistency work, which is now wrapped up in simpler recycling, which, if anything, isn't making recycling simpler at all.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, we will certainly come on in due course to the regulatory aspect of this, and also, I think, the more holistic view of what better packaging looks like. Justin, from Bunzl's perspective, what are you seeing in terms of customer demand for packaging materials, and what does that tell us about where their priorities lie? Are we still in that kind of anti-plastic stage, or is there a little bit more nuance coming back into the debate?
I think there's a couple of things here. So first of all, I very much, you know, what Martin and James have described is very much what we're seeing from that point of view. I think as far as the plastic kind of debate goes, it's now part of a much broader conversation and a much broader agenda. So I think we've seen that, and quite rightly, that you know, the issues or perceived issues around this particular material are still absolutely critical, and I think it makes up parts of conversations we're having with customers. There's not a tender recently that's gone through that doesn't still include areas where, you know, asking us where we can help them reduce plastic use or unnecessary plastic use, or support recycling or circular economic principles. But I think beyond that, there are the broader questions of, you know, how we're going to protect biodiversity and the environment within the supply chain, more understanding around carbon emissions within products and materials as well. But fundamentally, the conversations we're having with our customers, and Bunzl doesn't manufacture, so we're in quite a unique position that when we go to our customers, what we really want to understand is what they're trying to achieve with that packaging and what we can supply that's fit for purpose. And then I think you've got a kind of hierarchy from there. So, you know, I think there needs to be an understanding around compliance and legislation, which is becoming more and more complex as we go through. I've mentioned the supply chain, which I think is absolutely critical. But as we see more things coming to market as well, and different approaches, perhaps, and more novel approaches, disruptive elements within the marketplace as well, I think our clients and customers more and more need clarity on, you know, what claims are correct, what is marketing, what is perhaps, you know, going to butt up against the Green Claims Code and so on. So I think it's becoming a more and more complex conversation for good reason. And that, of course, brings in lots of other materials as well. But fundamentally, as Martin said, packaging needs to do its job in the first place. And certainly in the delivery market, you know, that's where certain materials very often do better than others.
James, looking at plastic specifically from a Nestlé perspective, is your priority to move away as far as possible from plastic, or rather to improve the design of plastic packaging, or to ensure that it is recyclable and ideally made from recycled materials rather than virgin plastics?
Yeah, I agree with everything that Martin and Justin has just said. And from a Nestlé point of view, you know, really importantly, we're ostensibly a dry food producer, and we sell over 1 billion products a day globally. And that's, you know, different environments, different cultures, different educations. And the packaging, whether it's plastic or metal or glass or whatever packaging we're using, it is chosen to do the right functionality for that product, to ensure that it gets to the customer in great condition, it extends shelf life and reduces food waste. So I really don't think it's a binary choice of demonizing plastic or saying we should move to some other sort of form of packaging. It's a much bigger conversation. And the packaging that we choose and that we use is framed around that one item of delivering that product to the consumer in good condition. Then we have, at retailers with their own packaging sustainability ideas. Tesco's have their rag list, their red, green, and amber list that they do allow certain packaging to be put into their supermarkets and packaging they won't allow to be put. So we have to follow what consumers are asking us and our retailers are asking us. But ostensibly, we will choose the correct packaging to deliver the product in good condition to our customers. I'm not a plastic apologist, but I think it needs to be discussed about, how plastic is used, how plastic is disposed of, how it's recycled. It's not plastic that gets into the environment itself. It's all of us that put it there.
So talk me through the process and how you sort of build a case for a particular material. So, for example, I purchased a bag of Smarty eggs the other day that was in paper packaging. Which hasn't been the case until fairly recently, I would imagine. So what process did you go through to determine that that was an appropriate material for that particular product?
There'll be an awful lot of product testing, shelf life testing, and we're very proud of the fact that the entire Smarties brand now is made out of paper. But because of the nature of that product, I'm not a product expert, but it's chocolate encased in a product that doesn't require such hard barrier properties from light and moisture. But as I say, for us, the packaging needs to keep water and moisture and light out of that product. And if that can work with paper and that can be recycled, then we'll do that. But then, being a company that is globally based and we're operating in a European market, the German legislation says that 95% of paper fiber content in paper will be recycled. The UK is at 90%, France is at 50%. So we have to go for the highest common denominator. And in some products that will work, and in other products it won't work. So that's how we have to make our choices on what substrate or what material we can choose to use.
Martin, there is clearly has been a lot of interest in paper-based packaging, both within the food service sector and the grocery sector as well, more widely. And the data, the research tends to show that consumers like it, or at least they like the idea that it's more sustainable, whether that, be reflective of the reality or not. Do you think that the sort of traction that paper has been getting is merited?
Well, paper isn't necessarily getting such a good press in total. I mean, let's face it. And I think in this mad rush to move away from plastic, we have to think about, when it goes to paper, is it just paper or is it paper combined with other things? What has happened to that paper and that board? Because I would find a coffee cup made of paper and nothing added to it. If I pour the coffee into it, I wonder what's going to happen. So there is something there. And I believe, and I mentioned it before, the unintended consequences. And there are lots here. And one of the unintended consequences is trying to get paper to emulate what plastic does. And as a result of it, making it less recyclable than what it's replaced. And this is something, and there are, look, I've spoken to journalists who don't really aren't bothered about that. They're not bothered about whether the alternatives work as well in protecting food. They just say, oh, no, you've got rid of some plastic. That's what it's all about. Well, it isn't what it's all about. you know, packaging has a huge role in feeding the population. And if packaging is going to fail or not keep food as fresh as, for longer as it should be, then we have problems, because it is a fairly delicate logistical process that we have. And if one part of the system fails, we have problems. We really do. And the other thing is, no matter, you know, change to paper, we're materially neutral, it still has to be collected, still has to be taken to somewhere and to be reprocessed. And if it's not going to do that as well as what it's replacing, then we're going backwards. And I think some of the stuff I'm seeing, and I'm sure Justin will want to comment here as well, has been taking steps backwards. And the public face of the packaging looks great. As far as the public are concerned, it's bored. They don't ask what lies behind. But packaging professionals and those in waste management, you know, look behind it and they get nightmares because there's nothing much you can do with this stuff. So we have to proceed with great caution.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think every customer I speak to about this is starts from the point of view that they want to do the right thing and they need to do the right thing. And that's because, you know, there is either a huge brand in front of it or because, you know, because that's the policies that they have. But I think it all comes from the right place and a good place. So when we sit down with a customer and they say, right, you know, we're looking at reviewing the range of packaging that we supply, or they're perhaps introducing something new and they want alternatives and they want to refresh it, the conversations are always started, always start and will always finish with how do we make this better? And I think, you know, as Martin's already pointed out, though, if you're going to certainly, I mean, what COVID did was obviously put a lot of stress, especially onto the restaurant sector, around trying to make more money out of deliveries, certainly. Now, if you're going to put something on the back of a bike, particularly if it's wet, a liquid, anything like that, you need a very robust and fit for purpose material to encase that. That's likely to be a plastic, probably. In which case, then it's about education and understanding how we can help consumers make the right decision when they've then used that. You know, can they return it? Can they do that? And also, you know, we've worked with customers who come from the point of view of going, right, well, we're going to have this and we're going to continue with it. So how do we make it better? So how can you drive extra, more recycled content, for example, into the packaging and therefore reduce its carbon footprint? How can we educate people so they know what to do with it at end of life? So I think very often it's about helping people, discussing what people's perceptions are, where their pressure points are with consumers and things like that, but then finding the right solution, which allows you to then kind of communicate that and get behind it and go on that journey together and help consumers make the right decision. And yes, yeah, sometimes that will be what, well, that will always be one material over another from that point of view. So I think that's a huge part of it. And I think that's generally kind of the way we're approaching it and what we're seeing. And I think if you sit down with someone and have a conversation, the end user about why you've made those decisions and they can see that it's been thought through, I think most people will understand. I think what a lot of people don't realize is that we then have to work with current infrastructure and current solutions. And I think the critical thing about that is that's not going to change anytime soon. There's not going to be a rapid, you know, the kind of infrastructure required to introduce new waste streams and things like that is very, very complicated and very, very expensive. So I think what we need to be looking at is how we can utilize what we have better, how we can get more value for money out of that, how we can design systems better, and then how we can also use forward-thinking organizations to trial solutions so that we understand what works and what doesn't. Otherwise, we go back to what James says, and you could drop a reusable process into an environment that's completely unsuited to that, and you just end up with lots more heavier materials and things going into that. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be doing reuse. We absolutely should. But I think the job of the industry and the job of what we're doing here and Nestlé are doing certainly is to understand where that works and where it doesn't. So you've got that complete toolkit to drop those things in to the right environments, basically.
So clearly there are, as much as we've seen, a lot of interest in paper, for example. There's a lot of investment and innovation around novel materials, often bio-based materials, seaweed, for example. I think palm leaf was one I was reading about the other day. Is the kind of systemic thinking that we've been talking about as important being applied to these silver bullets, novel packaging solutions, do you think, David? Or do you think there's a little bit of a sort of gap between the innovation at one end and the systems applicability at the other end?
I think it's certainly the latter, Nick. It's really interesting, all the novel materials that are, have a lot of potential, especially those that use sort of waste from other sectors and, things that would, ordinarily be wasted and can be recirculated, I suppose, for want of a better phrase. But it doesn't really help us with the systems thinking that we need around reduction and reuse. That would be my point, really, that, all these solutions are designed really so we can just keep consuming as much as we do, but we can't. So, yeah, great. Keep on trying these novel solutions, but why don't we spend as much money on reusable systems, would be my question to the others on the panel, maybe.
Yeah, I think reuse and refill systems, I think, globally, Nestle have run, I think, over 20 reuse and refill pilots with varying different levels of success. And I think we're starting to see change in some consumer behaviours. I'm reading and hearing sort of people going into retail stores and removing packaging and leaving it in the store, and people becoming more used to using some refill types of packaging that are reused types of packaging that are going on there. And I think it's something that we are certainly looking at Nestle, and I think it's something that will gain more traction, certainly with retailers and consumers and food service going forward in the future. And I think it's an important area that shouldn't be ignored, but it's quite immature in the UK market.
It's a shame that these materials, which is where this question started, are referred to as novel, because that suggests novelty. And that's a little bit unfair. They are new, different, emerging materials. David's point is correct. You just substitute one material for another material and you haven't changed a system. Every material, and with some of these not new materials or novel as you describe them, they are still plastics. And government does not draw a distinction. If it's got the poly as part of its process, that's pretty much a giveaway. That is a plastic. And so it is treated and defined as that legally for the purposes of plastics taxes and so on. But we still have to do something with them, as we would do with any material. Now, if some of them are designed to be composted, then they must go into a industrial composting system, and that needs to be more fully established. And I think it's a great shame for the composting community that the government's simpler recycling proposals don't have anything much in there for them. I mean, we haven't even got to the point of compostable caddy liners yet, which to me must be one of the most fundamental, obvious slam dunks. Why not? Just do it. What can be holding government back? I mean, government, as we all probably will agree, are the worst judges of most of this stuff. So systems, definitely. I mean, it's interesting. I noticed, you mentioned before, it was mentioned on one of the notes about the growth of seaweed. And that is interesting because I was, interviewed right at the very beginning when this project started off at Imperial, and were interviewed by what were then students. And yes, you can see, and there is a something which clearly is going to be develop, even if used as a liner. I mean, there's still much work to be done, but they've crossed a hurdle because they are able to prove they've not been chemically modified. And that is a pretty big deal as far as government definitions are concerned. So that would be certainly one to look for. On the subject of reusables, we're in favor of good reusable systems. The emphasis is on systems, not necessarily on the reusables themselves, but on the systems. I am so disappointed to see that all the money which has been spent on trials, and I'm thinking of a recent hubbub meeting I went to, has been wasted. The trials are too small. If this is going to work, it's got to work at scale. They're all far too parochial. It needs something of substance. And rather than lots and lots of little trials, it needs a big pot of money and putting together and doing something which is going to be working at scale. I mean, there'll be lots of problems to overcome, such as branding, because I don't want to lose that. Let's face it, this is about food service. Don't want to lose that. But overall, the trials are just too low-key, too low-level to have any merit.
Martin, do you feel like the big chains in this market would support larger-scale trials? Would they be able to put competitive concerns aside and actually contribute towards the national levels of trials that you're asking for? Because presumably that has been, I would imagine the likes of Hubbub would love to engage, would love to deliver national trials.
I bet they would. Yeah, of course they would. Financially, it'd be fantastic for them. I don't know legally what the position is on competition law. What I do know is businesses have spent fortunes, huge amounts of time, like Nestle, in building a brand, in building their visibility. And the great thing about food service is that visibility is carried up and down high streets, and lots of people see it. I would be so reluctant if I was one of the major players in food service to see that being lost. Now, I know the whole thing shouldn't be hung up on that, but it is a very practical barrier to have to get over. But it still comes back also just to a system, and those systems have got to be affordable. You can't have these systems where your kebab shop can't afford to partake in it because there's a barrier to entry, which is the minimum cost of getting involved in that system is so high.
I think this is about again, we just go back, we talked at the beginning about designing packaging and how people are making decisions and things like that. I think, again, we live in a world that is very black and white, isn't it? You're either on one side or another. I think the picture that we're painting here is actually one that is much more nuanced. And it's the fact that, yes, an independent kebab van is not going to necessarily at the moment join a nationwide reusable cup scheme or something like that, basically, or have that system. Although, actually, strangely, independents probably for years have been kind of taking back people's containers, filling them up, and so on. So there's kind of like two bits there. But I think if you look at there's a natural environment at the moment for reusable systems and things like that that work. Increasing that through in stadiums and events and things like that, because they sit quite nicely there. People know what they're doing. They're very enclosed and so on and so forth. As a business, we're launching a new range of reusable packaging, and we're getting a huge amount of interest from our customers about that, because, again, I think they want to understand what the best settings are to start with. And I guess it's a bit like a startup. We're at the early adopter stage at the moment. But actually, I think once that gets legs and people understand what works and where, the risk reduces slightly, because obviously there's a different kind of financial modeling about what you're paying for and when you're paying for it and so on. And people will gain more confidence in it. And then I think you'll see it take off. But similarly, I think we will see situations where people go, well, actually in that situation, single use is probably a better solution because the return rates are never going to be what they are, in which case the kind of material resource carbon impact is just going to be higher from that end. I think if we go back to the kind of the novel materials as well and things like that, I mean, it's quite interesting because you know, we talk about new things coming to market and so on. I suspect James and Martin, and I know myself, have been looking at a lot of these things for, I mean, I'm quite new to the industry, but I've been looking at them for the past 5 years. I suspect Martin's been looking at lots of things which are apparently new and coming to market, which have actually been kind of like coming backwards and forwards, but still don't seem to have quite fit into whether it is end of life or whether it is simply the fact that the claims that are being made about some of these materials don't stack up and are wishful thinking effectively. And I think, again, that's part of our job as we see it, is to take things to our customers and say, you know, we've looked at this, but it's not going to protect, it's not going to be a good brand carrier for you. It's not going to work within the systems you have, but here are some other systems. So I don't think it's black and white. I think it's about having, you know, for especially for major businesses or organizations and things like that, it's about having an arsenal of solutions which do allow you to be responsible with materials, but also allow you to reduce in certain areas, and then also allow you to, you know, have a better environmental impact across the board. So I think that's probably where we're seeing it move. But I don't see a situation where we will be a nation that always has a cup on us and always has a container on us. But obviously we will see an increase in that.
Justin, you touched upon the claims being made there, and often if you scratch beneath the surface of a press release, like I know David does frequently, you find that the claims being made for certain packaging materials or substitutions is not always what they purport to be. So what should we expect to see from businesses as they switch from one material to another in terms of substantiating the claims that they're making? Should we be expecting them to publish a detailed life cycle analysis in support of any claim they're making as a bare minimum?
Well, I certainly think what they should be making claims about, yeah, should be substantiated, and they should be reasonable, shouldn't they? So I think the one of the big ones is the kind of wishful thinking is that describing something that is recyclable, which is clearly not going to have any chance of making it through a system to be recycled, I think is probably, you know, the one we see most of from that point of view. So I think that's probably the challenge. And I think, you know, the whole environmental kind of legislation that's coming forward was designed or is designed to create greater clarity around that. And I think all people really want is to a level playing field, and they want to know, you know, how you measure something and how you do that. And I think the lack of consistency around that is something that takes up a lot of time, to be honest. And yeah, certainly we spend a lot of time with our clients coming to us and saying, oh, have you seen this? It looks perfect. It can do this, this, and this. And to be honest, it very often it is, well, yeah, quite some time it under the current rules, regulations, stats, or however it works with end of life solutions or whatever's proprietal or whatever, it's just not stacking up at the moment. And that's the real challenge for us.
Yeah, I think it's also very important. If I'm going to bring out an alternative and I'm doing it and I'm saying, and then I'm rubbishing what it's meant to be replaced, then yeah, you really do have to justify that. And you have to have evidence that a life cycle analysis, I would agree with. The only thing is we've never really agreed a format for life cycle analyses. And I think that is long, long overdue. So when Nestle bring out an alternative packaging for Smarties, they're doing it. But what Nestle aren't doing is they're saying, well, you know, the other stuff is rubbish and you shouldn't be using it. They're not doing that. They're doing their own thing. And that's perfectly fine. And there also are laws in this country as well, aren't they? When we make environmental claims, we have to be able to justify them. Green Claims Code, really important, but just normal normal trading standards, a lot of which we are watching, and I've had lots of conversations with Justin about it, we are seeing breached daily. And that's appalling because that distorts the playing field. The rules have got to apply to everyone and they've got to apply equally.
Again, I agree with a lot of what I've just heard. And, you know, I think Nestlé's in a particular firing line as a large company. And so we are very risk averse. We're very careful with what we say and what we do and the packaging that we put on the market. But we get internal pressures from our marketeers who say, our competitors are claiming this, why can't we claim it? And all this sort of stuff. PE paper coffee cups on the go are a classic. Lots and lots of people will claim that they're 100% recyclable, and technically they're correct, but, you know, they don't put in a closed loop only. So, you know, we get pressure from marketers to say, why can't we say this about our packaging? And it's because it wouldn't distinctly be true, really. And, you know, the furore that was made on social media when we changed our Quality Street wrappers from, you know, cellulose to paper, you know, we'd ruin Christmas. So, you know, it's, you can't do right for doing wrong type of thing. So it's a very complicated landscape, and you know, we have to be very careful about what we say and do.
Yeah, I think I'd agree mostly with what's been said as well, Nick. I think it can be tricky for companies who are trying to do good things to then communicate what they're doing. But what I have noticed is there's a bit, and this plays into, I suppose, Martin's point around the importance of branding as well, is there's a bit more secrecy about some of the novel approaches that I'm seeing. Marks and Spencer's new 100% recyclable and plastic-free cup, for instance, they won't say what it's lined with instead. It's confidential. So how do we use, you know, how can others, if it is such a fantastic cup, should we, and this is a question, should we be sharing that kind of intellectual property or innovation? And the other thing to say on sort of LCAs as well, I totally take the point that, you know, we don't have a standardized system and yes, we need one. But also it'd be great if companies could put this into context as well. What we see a lot of is, oh, we switched from X to Y and it's reduced X amount of plastic. What does that mean in relation to your net zero targets, for instance? That would be really interesting, because the thing I get asked a lot is, well, packaging's not really important, you know, in terms of when we're looking at net zero and carbon. For food service companies and drinks companies in particular, it definitely is. I mean, I looked up just before a couple of, you know, Nestlé's, for instance, 11 million tons of CO2 from its packaging. That's a fair, you know, it's a fair chunk. It's nowhere near the ingredient, James, in your sort of in the portfolio, but it's 4 million tons more CO2 than from the manufacturing side of the business. So it really is very important. And I think maybe we need a bit more of that, as to, you know, we're switching because it's saving us this and we're working towards net zero. And also, be honest, we're switching now because reuse isn't, for all those reasons that we've talked about, at scale, convenient, cost efficient yet. We're lacking government regulations.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, the regulatory landscape is probably another podcast in itself as well, given how dynamic and complex it is. And we don't have long left, but just briefly, if you all will, how do you see the uncertainty around the regulatory environment impacting businesses' decisions where materials and substitution are concerned? James, do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I would just say that I think from, you know, the regulatory landscape is really complicated at the moment. We're waiting to see the impact of EPR, DRS, simpler recycling, the packaging waste regulations from Europe. And from an Nestlé point of view, we're kind of having to sort of guess what may or may not happen. We don't know the fees for EPR yet. It's going to be a really huge cost to Nestlé. We're going to be paying 100% of the cost of the end of life management, of this packaging. Currently, with PRNs, packaging recovery notes, for those people that don't know what that is, listening to the podcast, we're paying about 37%. So we're going to have a huge increase in our costs. And we don't know how that's going to be managed, and we don't know where that money is going to go. And we're hoping that that money will go into investment in infrastructure, into recycling, to help the UK increase its recycling rates. And I think that's really important. And DRS, we're not sure what's going to happen with that. Simpler recycling, they're going to be putting the ability for consumers, households to recycle flexible packaging from the curbside. 215 billion pieces of flexible plastic put onto the UK market every year. We're currently recycling, I think, about 13% of that. How are we going to manage that increase in volume? How are we going to create an end market for that to just avoid this stuff going to energy recovery? So I think the regulatory landscape is really complicated, and we really need clarity from governments and understanding of how this is going to impact us. And it will impact the choice of materials that we use, for sure.
Justin, anything to add from a distributor's perspective?
It's from our point of view, it's certainly the journey we've had with EPR and things like that has been quite fraught at times, and we're still in that kind of in the middle of it. Basically, we've had to put a lot of resource behind it, and that's fine. But if we don't see the results that James has mentioned, so greater efficiency, better recycling rates, better service, communications and things like that, then I think all of the pain that the industry's been through will be wasted. And that will be a huge opportunity wasted, because we're not going to get this again for another probably decade or so anyway. So I think clarity, I mean, all we ever ask for as a business, and I think our customers ask for, is clarity around what needs to be done and what the outcomes are and the reasoning for that. And at the moment, it's difficult to say that we're getting that.
Well, we're in an election year, so perhaps we'll get that clarity by the end of the year, but perhaps not pin all our hopes on it. Look, we've come to the end of our time. It's been hugely insightful. I've certainly learned a lot myself, and I hope listeners have too. Thank you to my guests, to James, Justin, Martin and David. Thanks to Nestlé Professional for making this podcast possible, and thank you for listening.